will focus on challenges and solutions. Science, scientists, patients brought a lot. Let's go on. Without science, there cannot be durable solution to HIV epidemics. So now it's my very big pleasure to introduce a colleague and a friend, Professor Javier Martinez Picado. He is an ICRA research professor at the AIDS Research Institute, IRSI CAIXA, in Barcelona, in Spain, an institution that works to advance clinical research and translate this research into patient care. He received his PhD from the University of Barcelona, where he subsequently became associate professor lecturing on different microbiology-related subjects. In 1996, he joined the Massachusetts General Hospital as a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard Medical School, where he engaged in AIDS research. In 2000, he obtained a position as biomedical researcher of the Spanish Health Department, appointed to the hospital, excuse me for the accent, German Trias y Pujol in Badalona. The research program that Javier and his group is leading focus on the understanding from HIV causes disease in recently infected people, exploring the best antiviral treatment strategy, fighting drug resistance, and collaborating on global HIV/AIDS vaccine and the Europe network. Javier Martinez Picado is nowadays focusing his work on trying to put an agenda on the HIV cure. And this is the program he's going to give us this morning. Please, Javier.
Thank you. Thank you, Christine, for this kind, very nice kind introduction. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First, I would like to thank the conference organizers for the great honor of being invited to give this talk. But I would also like to thank the International AIDS Society, and in particular, Françoise Fagré-Sinoussi, for their commitment in the mission of finding a cure for HIV. Universal access to antiretroviral therapy remains an unquestionable human right that we all must support. But at the end, we must find a cure for HIV. Through this presentation, I will try to provide you with updated information on the limitations to cure HIV, the potential strategies to achieve a cure, the current clinical trials aim at cure, and current and future challenges in this field. I think that is out of question that HIV inhibition with antiretroviral therapy has been one of the major successes in modern medicine. We have seen over the 25 years how newer and better drugs have improved the life of many HIV-infected people. However, despite long-term effective treatment, drugs do not cure HIV infection, as evidenced by the detection of cell-associated DNA and RNA in most patients treated with antiretroviral therapy. It is also possible to rescue ex vivo replication-competent virus from blood lymphocytes. Persistent low-level viremia measured with ultra-sensitive assays can be detected in nearly all the patients on antiretroviral therapy. And all this happens in blood, but it's believed that tissues are an even greater source of persistent viremia. But probably the most definitive proof of viral persistence despite antiretroviral therapy is the quick viral rebound detectable in the blood of patients that discontinue antiretroviral therapy. Moreover, despite treatment achieves a rapid and durable inhibition of the virus, there are major reasons to pursue a definitive cure. Mortality in people with HIV infection continues to decrease as treatment improves. However, it is still higher than that of non-infected people, most likely due to higher levels of inflammation and immune activation. The incidence of cancer, liver disease, cardiovascular disease, and bone loss is higher in treated patients compared to HIV uninfected people, especially when CD40 cells counts are low. New HIV transmissions need to be urgently reduced. For every HIV infected person who starts antiretroviral therapy, 2 new individuals are infected with HIV. And stigma and discrimination continues in spite of access to antiretroviral therapy. But more importantly, HIV treatment is currently a long life commitment, implying adherence problems, potential toxicities, and especially the ability to sustain its long-term costs. The most optimistic models estimate that annual cost by 2015 will be over $22 billion to achieve universal access to HIV prevention, treatment, care, and support. Therefore, novel time-limited treatment strategies allowing sustained viral remission in absence of antiretroviral therapy should bring individual, global, and economical benefits. If we want to identify strategies that will lead to an HIV cure, we need first to understand what are the different mechanisms that contribute to HIV persistence in spite of antiretroviral therapy. First, we have to face the possibility of having some residual but persistent viral replication below the limit of detection of the current assays. The second mechanism of viral persistence is latency, understood as the presence of non-transcriptionally active viral genomes integrated in the cell DNA. And finally, there is the evidence that immune activation and inflammation do not normalize in HIV-infected subjects, often despite long-term antiretroviral therapy. The cause and clinical relevance of this persistent immune dysfunction remains unclear. Whether residual replication persists during suppressive antiretroviral therapy is still controversial. It is believed that HIV burden in tissues and organs, including gut mucosa, genital tract, lymph nodes, and central nervous system, might be greater than that in peripheral blood, contributing to sustained residual replication. Maybe as a consequence of the variable drug penetration in different tissues, or to the possibility of the virus to spread from cell to cell at high multiplicity. It's also challenging to interpret the evolution of virological as well as immunological markers upon treatment intensification with new drug families. But on the other hand, the major argument supporting the lack of residual viral replication focus in the absence of evolution in RNA and DNA viral sequences of patients on antiretroviral therapy, including the absence of drug-resistant mutations, as well as the lack of quantitative changes in either HIV RNA or DNA following treatment intensification. The second mechanism of viral persistence is latency. Resting memory CD40 cells have been described as a major reservoir for HIV. Even so, less than one cell per million resting CD40 cells from patients on antiretroviral therapy carry latent replication-competent virus. Activated cells can get infected and produce new virions, but antiretroviral therapy should efficiently stop new cells from being infected, leading to a quick clearance of circulating virus and their producing cells. However, a small proportion of activated HIV-infected CD4 T cell could revert to a resting stage, harboring integrated HIV DNA. Alternative resting CD4 T cells can also be infected without becoming activated. The maintenance of this otherwise heterogeneous reservoir is based in its slow decay due to the long half-life of these cells, their capacity to proliferate, and the existence of negative regulators that would limit their capacity to activate and induce the expression of integrated virus. Despite resting memory CD4 T cells is the best well-characterized reservoir, there are other potential reservoirs that would require further studies, including naive T cells, tissue macrophages, astrocytes, thymocytes, and perhaps hematopoietic stem cells. Based on our current knowledge, one might wonder what could be the potential strategies to achieve a cure. We can envision a cure from two different perspectives, either from the eradication point of view in line with the sterilizing infectious model in which any trace of virus or infected cell has to be fully eliminated from the body. The support to this model comes from a very unique case of possible cure, the Berlin patient, that I will discuss later on. Alternatively, we might consider the functional cure model that aims at the generation of effective host immunity to HIV that would result in long-term control of the virus in the absence of therapy, despite not achieving a complete eradication of HIV. The best approach to this option is the study of a limited group of patients that control viremia, either spontaneously, the elite controllers, or after early time-limited treatment, the post-treatment controllers. And to achieve either a functional or an sterilizing cure, we have to design strategies to explore how treatment optimization and intensification might help to eliminate all traces of ongoing viral replication. We now know that early treatment initiation, a primary infection, may limit the size of the viral reservoir. How to purge integrated HIV DNA from the cells? How to reverse molecular signals responsible to maintain latency? How therapeutic vaccines might contribute to enhance host control of the virus? And how gene therapy might be implemented to make cells resistant to HIV infection or to specifically disrupt integrated HIV genomes? A number of pilot studies have already been performed to explore the role of treatment intensification in residual viral replication. Most of them have taken advantage of more recently developed drugs, especially the integrase inhibitor raltegravir. This table lists most of the intensification studies in this field. I would like, however, to emphasize that their design is significantly different in sample size, longitudinal follow-up, and level of CD4 T cell counts, making comparisons between them difficult. Moreover, only two of them look into tissues, specifically gut-associated lymphoid tissue. All the studies fail to show any further reduction in residual plasma viremia by using ultra-sensitive viral load assays, and total HIV DNA remain also stable during intensification. Only two studies show markers of new infection despite treatment. One study showed a transient but significant increase in episomal HIV DNA right after raltegravir intensification, and a significant decrease in CD8 T cell activation during the entire follow-up. A second study showed a decrease in cell-associated HIV RNA in a particular site of the gut, the terminal ileum, that is rich in lymphoid tissue, and a trend in reducing immune activation as well. In the last years, we have also increased the screening of new compounds that might be helpful to reduce latently infected cells. Several molecular mechanisms of latency have been proposed, including insufficient levels or access of host transcriptional factors to the promoter region of HIV. Transcriptional factors and interference of host promoter activities, chromatin remodeling, and epigenetic silencing. In this list, you can see some of the drugs that have been selected in vitro models of viral latency and reactivation. On your left-hand side, you can see those that are quickly moving towards clinical trials, and I will next extend a little bit in those marked in red. The French scientific program, or BACS, is currently sponsoring two long-term studies in Europe and North America. Euroimmune 1, led in Europe by Christine Caldama, combines treatment intensification with valtegravir and maraviroc in patients with successful antiretroviral therapy for at least 3 years, and the use of IL-7 to explore whether this cytokine stimulates HIV reactivation from latently infected resting cells via the activation JAK-STAT pathway. The twin study, Euroimmune 2, led in North America by Robert Murphy, adds a DNA prime and adenovirus boost vaccine strategy to stimulate cellular immune responses, also in subjects receiving intensified antiretroviral treatment. The primary endpoint for both studies is the reduction of total HIV DNA in peripheral bloods. Definitive data on the two studies is expected before the end of this year. Interferon alpha is also under screening. Drugs based on this antiviral substance are used to treat hepatitis C infection. Earlier studies on HIV-infected individuals who were not on any antiretroviral therapy show that interferon alpha could reduce the level of HIV in the blood. Researchers at the NCI, led by Frank Maldarelli, are interested in determining whether interferon therapy will also reduce the residual low levels of HIV in patients who are already taking antiretroviral therapy. Preliminary data in 4 patients suggests that despite a transient and reversible effect of interferon alpha on immune activation, there was no further decline in the levels of residual plasma viremia or total HIV DNA in blood cells. As I said before, chromatin remodeling is one of the potential factors involved in HIV silencing. Histone acetylation and DNA methylation would induce chromatin remodeling to allow gene expression of integrated HIV, virus manufacturing, and potentially, although not completely clear yet, the killing of virus-producing cells. Histone deacetylase inhibitors, also called HDAC inhibitors, is a family of molecules that facilitates such conformational change on the cell chromatin. Vorinostat is a potent HDAC inhibitor, able to activate HIV from latency in vitro. This drug is licensed for cutaneous T-cell lymphoma and is in different phase 2 trials for other malignancies. 2 studies on successfully treated subjects are in process in the US and Australia. The US study, led by David Margolis, is based on 3 single doses of vorinostat during antiretroviral therapy, while the Australian trial, led by Sharon Lewin, is a continuous dose study during 14 days. In both studies, the final endpoint is the in vitro reactivation of latent HIV as measured by cell-associated HIV RNA, either in resting CD4 T cells in blood for the American study or total CD4 cells in blood and rectum for the Australian one. While data for the Australian study is still pending, preliminary data for the US study shows a 5-fold significant increase in the expression of HIV RNA after vorinostat administration, in absence of any detectable short-term adverse events. Certainly, this is promising. Disulfiram is also an FDA-approved drug to treat alcohol dependence. Its capacity to reactivate HIV gene expression has been demonstrated in an in vitro model of latency. A joint short-term pilot clinical study led by Steve Dix is ongoing in two U.S. sites on subjects with successful antiretroviral therapy, and disulfiram is given for 14 continuous days. Despite a transient but significant increase in low-level viremia, right after the first dose of disulfiram, there was no significant increase in the reactivation of replication-competent virus from the latent reservoir. A completely different strategy comes from the gene therapy field, which main goal is to make patient cells resistant to HIV infection. Part of the recognition that a cure for HIV is feasible comes from an extraordinary case report, the so-called Berlin patient, a 40-year-old HIV-infected man who was responding well to antiretroviral therapy, developed acute myeloid leukemia. He needed complex medical interventions, including chemotherapy, total body irradiation, and stem cell bone marrow transplant. Remarkably, the selected compatible donor had a very unusual deletion in the CCR5 gene, a gene that is essential to produce a key cellular receptor for HIV entry. 5 years after the transplant, the patient remains off antiretroviral therapy with no viral rebound. Despite that extensive interventions to search for any trace of HIV in his body are still ongoing, this might be the first ever documented patients apparently cured from HIV infection. Unfortunately, this type of interventions is so complex and risky that would not be applicable on a large scale. But this case has led to alternative interventions that take advantage of the gene therapy. The synthetic thin finger nucleases is a molecular tool engineered by the company Sangamo to cleave virtually any gene sequence. If designed to disrupt the CCR5 gene, somehow mimicking the natural rare deletion might help to make lymphocytes refractory to HIV infection. Pilot trials in the east and west coast of the U.S. are ongoing. Lymphocytes from subjects responding well to antiretroviral therapy are treated ex vivo with zinc finger nucleases to disrupt the CCR5 gene, then expanded and reinfused to the patient. Modified T cells show engraftment, proliferation, and persistence in blood and rectal mucosa, suggesting that they retain their functional characteristics despite of the treatment. The CD4 cell counts increase and the ratio CD4-CD8 improve after the intervention. However, the number of genetically modified cells did not substantially increase. The question remains whether this system could be applicable to hematopoietic stem cell progenitors. Also, if the alternative viral entry receptor, CXCR4, also needs to be targeted, and if an in vivo product for this medical intervention could ever be developed. Other potential strategies targeting HIV cure are under current design, including RNA-based therapies. But given the multiple mechanisms that may contribute to HIV persistence, most likely an effective intervention will require the combination of multiple strategies. The field is quickly advancing, and intellectual, financial, and social coordination are essential in this trip. Over the last 2 years, the International AIDS Society has convened a group of international experts to to develop a roadmap for research towards an HIV cure. The inaugural global scientific strategy towards an HIV cure was launched by Françoise Borré-Sinoussouy and Steve Dix right ahead of this conference. I would like to publicly thank both of them for their outstanding commitment and leadership. The strategy is now published online in Nature Reviews Immunology and identifies 7 important priority areas for basic, translational, and clinical research and maps out a path for future research collaboration and funding opportunities. Many are the challenges ahead of this area. To ensure effective outcomes to this research, international cooperation will be critical. This includes successful crosstalk between basic and clinical science, HIV and non-HIV scientists, public and industrial sectors, and the key involvement of the community, regulatory agencies, and stakeholders. Different institutions and agencies have outlined in the last years specific programs to tackle HIV cure. Financial resources specifically invested in this area, without neglecting other key priorities in HIV care, will be crucial to achieve the proposed goal. And we hope the global scientific strategy towards an HIV cure will encourage others to further investment. The scientific and technical recommendations made by the International AIDS Society Scientific Working Group on HIV cure include, first, to review basic science and to understand the cellular, viral, and immunological mechanisms to control HIV persistence. Second, to develop new assays and experimental models to tackle viral reservoirs, including tissues and cellular sources in long-term antiretroviral treated individuals. Here, development of animal models of latency would also be critical. And third, to investigate new therapeutic agents and immunological strategies to achieve viral remission in absence of antiretroviral therapy. But there are also other critical considerations that need to be implemented. Community engagement is essential to discuss expectations and acceptability of proof-of-concept cure studies. There are ethical as well as regulatory issues regarding individual risks and toxicities of these interventions in subjects that are otherwise doing well on antiretroviral therapy. Any successful intervention needs to be safe, affordable, and scalable to reach anyone who does need it. Indeed, cure and vaccine research are two inseparable priorities towards a world free of AIDS. I would like to conclude my talk with 2 slides. The first one is to thank the people who helped me to put this presentation for you. My special acknowledge to Sharon Levin, Steve Dix, and Françoise Barré-Sinoussouy. But I would also like to thank all my colleagues at the International AIDS Society Scientific Working Group on HIV Cure for 2 years of intensive and fruitful collaboration. And the very final one is to remind you that, realistically, the quest of finding a cure for HIV will require a prolonged period of investigation in many, many areas. However, this complexity should not prevent our effort. Meanwhile, continuous investment to secure universal access to prevention, treatment, care, and support should remain a top priority. Thank you very much for your attention and commitment. Thank you.
Please welcome Dr. and Senator Bill Frist. Senator Frist is both a nationally recognized heart and lung transplant surgeon and former U.S. Senate Majority Leader.
Dr. Nelly Mugo is a research scientist an obstetrician gynecologist at Kenyatta National Referral Hospital, Kenya. She has worked on two multi-site HIV-1 prevention clinical trials as a regional director for the Partners in Prevention HSV-HIV Transmission Study and site investigator for the Partners PrEP study sponsored through the International Clinical Research Center, Department of Global Health, and University of Washington. She is currently the head of research and programs at Kenyatta National Hospital, Kenya. Join me in welcoming Dr. Nelly Mugo.
Good morning, everybody.
I'd like to thank the conference organizers for giving me this opportunity to talk to you about implementation science and realizing the HIV prevention revolution. We've heard a lot about where we are with the pandemic in this conference, and it remains a global health challenge. From 1980s to present, 30 million people have died. The current population of Kenya is 40 million. It's not a small number of people. The current estimate is that we have 34 million people living with HIV/AIDS, and in that 1 year, 2.7 million were newly infected, with 1.8 million deaths, close to the population of Swaziland. AIDS is still the commonest cause of death in Africa and the sixth most common globally. 30 years into the HIV epidemic, as we have heard, new research has demonstrated that we have powerful interventions that can prevent new infections. So for the very first time, we can begin to visualize a future free from HIV/AIDS as a feasible goal. So, what do we need to change to deliver the HIV prevention services? We need to start thinking about the populations who are most at risk for targeted interventions. Then we will need to prioritize those interventions that work within those populations and deliver this in combination with high coverage for us to get high impact. So thinking populations, I looked at data on where are new HIV infections coming from, specifically in generalized epidemics in hyper-endemic areas in sub-Saharan Africa, and I took data from my own home country in Kenya, where married and cohabiting couples contribute 44% of new infections. This figure is true of other countries in the region like Swaziland, Lesotho, Uganda, and Malawi, where heterosexual unions contribute the majority of new infections. For a long time, we didn't think about other marginalized populations like men who have sex with men and injection drug users in our countries. But in Kenya, from this data analysis, MSMs, sex workers, and a small proportion of injection drug users contribute a quarter of new infections. In addition to this, we know that injection drug users have high risk of transmission at any one event. And casual heterosexual sex contributes another 20% in these populations. So we've said that heterosexual couples are key and at highest risk of new infections. And we also know that HIV serodiscordancy is common. Across many data sets, we've learned that 50% of partners of HIV-infected individuals are also HIV-negative. And the risk of transmission when couples do not know that they are serodiscordant is up to 14%. Now, in the absence of couples counseling and testing, it would be very difficult to know who is at risk and who needs to be targeted for intervention. From our own studies, we've learned that serodiscordant couples' desire for children overshadows fear of infection and is often a risk driver, something that we need to think about. Thinking about these marginalized populations, they require prioritization for intervention.
HIV prevalence in these populations is high, and I take data from the Sex Worker Project in Kenya, where 40% of the men who have sex with men are HIV infected, and 28% of the sex workers. And the sex worker cohort prevalence has stayed the same from the 80s. When they initiate and enroll these people in the cohorts, only about 20% know how to correctly use a condom. I've seen many presentations in this forum looking at the issues of social and political environment for these marginalized populations that are keeping them reluctant to seek health services. There are legal issues. For example, in Kenya, sodomy is illegal and can lead to a 14-year jail sentence. I know from our media that some of my neighboring countries have harsher sentences for men who have sex with men. They also experience social condemnation, religious intolerance, physical and sexual abuse. We cannot have an HIV revolution without the youth. Data shows us that 42% of new infections occur amongst youth aged 15 to 24. 80%, 4 million youth of these infections are in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, if we targeted this population, think about what a remarkable difference we could make in a couple of years in the number of new infections. In addition to the issue of youth is the young woman who has twice the HIV infection rate that is found in young men. I looked at data from the Kenya AIDS Indicator Survey 2007, where we found that 65% of new infections amongst women occurred before the age of 35. This pattern holds true both in South and Eastern African countries. So thinking about populations, we need to prioritize our activities to be specific to the priority population. And we need to think about their vulnerabilities and address those vulnerabilities and deliver them a comprehensive package specifically designed for the population. So prioritizing interventions that work. In 2011, we were jubilant because research provided very clear and unequivocal evidence that antiretroviral treatment and pre-exposure prophylaxis work for the prevention of sexual transmission of HIV. So in 2012, we know the what. The question is, how do we deliver? HPTN-052, I think many of us are very familiar with this data, the randomized clinical trial of immediate versus delayed antiretroviral therapy in couples. Amongst the linked transmission, only one occurred in the arm where they had immediate antiretroviral, and this one infection occurred very soon after heart had been initiated. So treatment in this cohort had a 96% reduction in HIV transmission. Of interest are the 11 unlinked infections, 25%, which we would assume did not happen between the partnership. And that's something to keep in mind when we think about treatment as prevention. Antiretrovirals will only work when they are taken, true of many things. And in HPTN, viral suppression was near universal, reflecting intensive strategies, including quarterly monitoring and individual counseling, to achieve this near-perfect adherence. So as we move into treatment as prevention, we will have to reflect on how we can continue to achieve these very high adherence levels and suppression levels. So I'll shift a little bit and go to pre-exposure prophylaxis. And we have three pivotal trials results in different population groups. We have IPREX, amongst men who have sex in men, which was conducted across three continents, with 2,500 young men randomized to Truvada and placebo, which demonstrated a protection of 44%. TDF2 was in heterosexual men and women in Botswana, again using Truvada, demonstrated a protective effect of 62%. Partners PrEP, which is the study I'm involved with, amongst heterosexual HIV serodiscordant couples in Kenya and Uganda, Truvada demonstrated a protective effect of 25%. All this data is currently published. PrEP, like antiretroviral therapy, works when taken. And when we look at this, results of blood samples where tenofovir was detected, we can see in partner's PrEP where 81% of the samples had detectable drug, there was 75% efficacy. And there's a clear dose response between the evidence of PrEP use and efficacy. If you go down, we'll see that in FemPrep, a study of young women, only 26% of them had demonstrable drug, and the study was stopped for futility and was not effective, did not demonstrate any effectiveness in protection. So the question is, what motivates PrEP use? Risk perception is key, and it's a behavioral issue. Just another reminder that our interventions cannot be biomedical, that we must have a behavioral arm in impacting the epidemic. Serodiscordant couples have a known HIV-infected partner. They've chosen to stay together, and this helps and motivates adherence. While in FemPrep, it was found that 70% of the women did not perceive themselves at risk for HIV, and it resulted in very low adherence. Yet HIV incidence in that population was 5%. So risk perception is key for any strategy to be effective. As we move into these populations, we need to find how to make people understand and perceive their risk if they're going to take up the interventions that we offer to them. Again on PrEP, just to keep in mind that we don't envision PrEP to be a lifelong intervention. It's something we perceive can be taken for a season. Very often, risk is in a limited period of time. When we look at data from adolescent women, they have a season of vulnerability, and high prevalence is within the age of 16 to 24. Against serodiscordant couple, from our own data, the highest risk occurred when couples wanted to conceive. Young men who have sex with men are equally vulnerable. Amongst couples, it's been noted that times of vulnerability include intimate partner violence, when people have a new partner, when there's depression, alcohol use, and perhaps we can think about conflict zones when there's a lot of abuse going on. Last week, FDA approved a label indication for Truvada for HIV prevention. So we have a really powerful tool that can be safely used by populations of vulnerable HIV-negative individuals. We've worked for this and waited for it for several decades for a tool that's under the control of a negative man or a woman. Previously, everything needed to be negotiated between partners. Just to keep in mind where we've come from in ART, when we talked about ART in Africa, and it was said that a high proportion of patients would be unlikely to adhere well unless there was intensive resource to support adherence programs. But we know this has proven not to be true. And ART in Africa has happened, and we can do a lot more with what we know. Just a reminder that we have many tools for HIV prevention. From 2007, we confirmed that male circumcision is very effective. Treatment of STIs, condoms, which do not cost much, are highly efficacious, and other behavioral interventions and counseling. And more recently, we heard about tenofovir gel. We've talked about PrEP and post-exposure prophylaxis and treatment as prevention. So we have a large large toolbox to select from, and we need to use these tools in combination to make them effective. So looking at voluntary medical male circumcision, it was very refreshing to get these results from extended follow-up from the Rakai study, demonstrating a 68% effectiveness extended long after the randomized clinical trial ended. And similar results have been seen in Kenya and South Africa trial sites without any evidence of risk compensation. So prioritizing what works, we finally have additional tools for a package of interventions. We haven't been here before. So we need to revisit and revise how we prioritize our tools. We need to focus resources and efforts on what is proven and impactful. And more challenging is to be ready to get rid of those policies and approaches that do not work. So what we need to do as a revolution and a change is to target the populations and provide them with relative packages. So delivering in combination and with higher coverage for impact so that we can have synergies of effective interventions in combination. Interventions that reduce infectiousness, like treatment as prevention using condoms. Interventions that reduce HIV susceptibility, like male circumcision, pre-exposure prophylaxis, and when available, a vaccine, together with behavioral interventions. And this will need to be delivered with high coverage for them to have high impact. I borrowed this slide from Dr. Min on Sunday, and I thought that Cambodia had done a good job to look at the fact that HIV prevention is a team effort. The inclusion of police, media, campaigns, and local authorities in targeting men who have sex with men before they come into our healthcare services for prevention. So we cannot work alone to make this difference. We know that testing is the gateway to prevention, and acceptability of HIV testing is high in large-scale campaigns and home-based testing. However, it's important that testing is linked to services, and we don't just accrue numbers of people tested. This will require systems for effective linkages to services. So we recognize that delivery of highly effective prevention interventions will not be without challenges. We've seen the treatment cascade from the U.S., and this is a meta-analysis from sub-Saharan data. And we see out of 100% of people tested, we lose some and only 72% get CD4 measurements. 40% of these were found to be eligible, and only 25% of those eligible started ART. So to actually achieve treatment as prevention and have impact, we will require very high testing coverage. We will need to improve our linkage to care so that we can achieve community viral suppression to reduce infectiousness and HIV incidence at a community level. There are other issues around treatment, the willingness to start antiretroviral. I think in yesterday's afternoon meeting, we heard that HIV-infected people do not want to feel like they're compelled to take treatment to prevent transmission. And this data from South Africa, in an environment where 35% of the population was found to be HIV-infected, 29% were eligible, and of them, 20% declined treatment. And the most common reason was that they felt well and did not see reason to commence treatment. We do not have a lot of experience starting antiretroviral in people who are asymptomatic. In my own site in Thika, we talked to HIV-positive members of discordant couples. 42% of men and 31% of HIV-infected women said they wouldn't start ART solely for the purpose of lowering the chance of infecting their partner. Part of their concerns included fear of side effects, fear of stigma, peer burden, and the potential for developing resistance. All is not lost, and there have been demonstrations of improving testing and linkages to care. These results come from Mozambique in a province called Tete, where patient empowerment improved retention to care, and they formed support groups of patients where they supported adherence, supported clinic visits, and they had very high retention of 97%. They only had 2 people lost to follow-up and 2 deaths. I think that was remarkable on what the community can do when they're involved in making a difference to what happens to them. Other ways of improving testing and leakages has been shown by having home-based testing where there's very high coverage and uptake. Point-of-care CD4 count reduces clinic visits and cost of patients going to the clinic, and community delivery of antiretroviral. This was demonstrated in work from KwaZulu-Natal. Now, thinking about ART for prevention and PrEP for HIV prevention, we find that they have similar challenges and opportunities. Both require adherence. People ask about sexual risk-taking, and I think the balance to this question is to think whether risk-taking will be sufficient to undermine the prevention benefit. What is assuring is that from our own clinical trial data set, we did not observe any risk compensation, and that the circumcision data also does not show risk compensation. There's been questions about resistance. We know that people on treatment will develop resistance when there's poor adherence, and some of this has been seen to be rising in Africa. In PrEP, because it hasn't been taken to the community, from the clinical trial data, resistance was observed only amongst those who were commenced PrEP during acute infection. And we need to weigh this against the number of infections that were averted. Who is likely to use these interventions? For ART, we know it needs to be lifelong. But for PrEP, we think that you only need to use PrEP during that season of vulnerability. So it shouldn't be a lifelong intervention. Who will pay? I think these discussions have been discussed by people more able than I, and I'm reassured in being in this conference to have had the support and possibility of funding to make these interventions work. For antiretroviral, now that we've only recently gotten the data, there are proposed demonstration projects. And we see PrEP as a bridge in couples, and we'll be commencing this study among serodiscordant couples with three arms. We know that those will be those people who are eligible for ART, and PrEP will be offered as a bridge for 6 months before full viral suppression. Amongst HIV-infected individuals who decline PrEP, who decline ART, PrEP will be offered to the negative partner. And for those not yet eligible, PrEP will be offered to the HIV-negative partner. Now, look again at implementation of prevention and the rollout of male circumcision, which shows substantial country differences. The target was 80% of target populations, and we have variation between 41% in Kenya and 0.1% in other countries in uptake of these interventions. There's some lessons learned. I got this from my colleague and friend, Kawango, that HIV prevention plan must be community-owned at all levels, from government to local communities. For circumcision in Kenya, the Luo Council of Elders endorsed medical male circumcision. There was a lot of public education through social media. And for population impact, there was a need to target. So in Kenya, circumcision was targeted in Nyanza, where there's the lowest rates of circumcision and highest HIV prevalence. There's need to be flexible and creative, constantly monitor and evaluate so that problems are caught early and interventions are built in, and that there's a need to start and simply just do it. We are reassured by results from prevention of mother-to-child transmission. And on Sunday, we heard from the mayor of this city that they haven't seen a neonatal HIV infection from 1999. And ARVs have been what has made this feasible. However, in context, we must remember that this has happened in combination of both ART as biomedical interventions and behavioral interventions like family planning and preventing infections in young women. So in summary, what am I saying? I'm saying that we need to target populations for interventions, not start with the interventions. We need to target the populations, so we need to change course and apply the interventions that fit that population and have an appropriate intervention package for each population. I think it's clear that the interventions and the things that work for men who have sex in men in Cambodia may be very different for heterosexual individuals in Africa. We have proven interventions which are highly effective. So we must carefully select both biomedical and behavioral tools which are appropriate for each at-risk population. For high impact, we must have high coverage, and we need to link testing to services. So we need to move away from standalone HIV testing, and we need to reduce the leakages from testing to when people get intervention. And the process of prevention needs to involve the communities for them to really have high impact. So in conclusion, I'd like to say that we have a real opportunity in the history of this disease to make a remarkable difference and save lives. I think this is not a choice, this is an obligation. And we shall be judged on how well we use the knowledge that we have to save lives, to save men and women from getting infected with HIV, and hopefully fulfill our dream for future generations of an HIV-free life. So I'd like to acknowledge the conference organizers for inviting me, my own home institutions, all of you investigators, advocates, sponsors, and everybody who seeks new HIV prevention tools, the Kenya Prevention Revolution, which has been thinking in this line, specifically Nduko, Kilonzo, Peter Cherotich. And I'd like to thank Jared Betten, Connie Kellam, who've worked with me, and all of you for listening to me today. Thank you. Asante ni sana.
Please welcome Dr. Stefano Bertozzi, Director of HIV Global Health Programs at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Thank you. It is my distinct pleasure to be able to introduce Dr. Bernhard Schwartländer, a longtime friend and colleague. Bernhard is currently the Director for Evidence, Innovation, and Policy at UNAIDS, where he's been for the last 2 years. He moved to Geneva from Beijing, where he was the UNAIDS country coordinator. And prior to that, Bernhard was at the Global Fund, where he was director for performance evaluation and policy. And prior to that, the director of the WHO HIV department. I think we met when he was still director of the National AIDS Program in Germany. He was trained largely in Germany, but the U.S. also claims him as a favored son because he did part of his training at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We will now listen to him present on what does it take to turn the tide.
Thank you, Steph. Dear friends, like many of you, I have been in the fight against AIDS for a long time. Together, we have seen years of despair, which after the Durban Conference in 2000 turned around to become an amazing decade of progress and hope. Thanks to civil society activism, we have seen resources grow to a point where we have turned around the pandemic. Infections are dropping in many countries, millions are getting affordable treatment, and even in the most affected countries, the number of people who die of AIDS have come down significantly. The science of HIV has also made tremendous progress, so much that it has instigated a new bold vision of getting to zero. We now dare to think of a world with zero new infections, zero discrimination, and zero AIDS-related deaths. We have a long way to go. We need to invest in what we know works, and as I will show you, that is possible. As much change as we have seen in the world of AIDS, today it is the world outside AIDS that is even changing more dramatically. My message today is simple. In this new and complex world, all the poverty is as big a problem as ever. The days when we had a simple world of rich countries and poor ones is gone. And with it, we should abandon the concept of dependency and charity, as well as habitual ways of thinking and acting. We should explore the many exciting new possibilities for collaboration, activism, financing that this world offers. In this environment, the forces that will make the difference are horizontal and partnership-based. The fight against AIDS must be one of shared responsibility and global solidarity between activists and governments, among all countries, independent of their income, and among men and women. Friends, what are these dramatic changes? First, the dramatic rise in resources from official development assistance has come to an end and aid dedicated to fighting AIDS has remained flat since 2009, at least for now. So while we continue to advocate for donor funding, we need to learn how to do more with what we have got. We need to focus on the specific conditions that facilitate HIV transmission and prioritize the interventions that make the most difference. 1 year ago, we proposed a strategic investment framework to do exactly this. This framework focuses on six basic programs that have been proven to work. We must invest our precious resources in them, but we must also invest sufficient resources in programs called critical enablers that create the social and legal environment that actually enables people to take up these basic programs and stay on them. This means investing in ending discrimination, gender inequality, and protecting vulnerable populations. Let me show you what we can achieve by applying this new approach. Here you can see what happens if you continue with the same investment level over the coming 10 years and do the same old things that we have done so far. Exactly nothing. We can pour $16 to $17 billion every year into fighting AIDS without budging the number of new infections. This, on the other hand, is what the strategic investment framework is likely to achieve through focus and bringing down the costs. It requires a certain boost in investments for a while, peaking at an additional $7 billion in 2015, and then goes down gradually. $7 billion is a doable proposition, even in this environment. In return, we will drive new infections down by well over half in less than 5 years. This certainly does look like a good investment to me. And for me, the choice is clear. Let us pay now and not forever. To start with, we need to focus on doing the right things. Let me show you what a difference it makes what a country chooses to invest in. Brazil and the Russian Federation have roughly the same population size, the same GDP, and they roughly invest the same amount of money in fighting AIDS. Yet the results in terms of new infections are vastly different. Russia clearly does not get a good return for its investment. Russia's refusal to grant access to evidence-informed HIV prevention and treatment services to people who use drugs and other key populations not only violates their human rights, it also renders its AIDS response ineffective and wastes the domestic resources allocated to HIV. Unfortunately, Russia is not alone. Many countries fund programs driven by ideology, not evidence, and fail to protect key populations from the discrimination and violence that make it almost impossible for them to take up and stay on prevention and treatment. But as Brazil and other countries show, poor investments and outcomes can be avoided. We do need to do the right things, but we also need to do the right things the right way. Colleagues and friends, something very interesting is happening. As you see on this chart in Africa, treatment numbers have to continue to go up in the past 2 years despite a stagnation in funding. A lot of very clever and dedicated people are making sure that services are delivered more efficiently and making sure that more people receive services for the same amount of money. And many of you are sitting in this room today. Let us be inspired by all of those who make this happen. And there's more we can do. We can use innovation better, find new ways of preventing resistance, simplify procedures and use low-tech community-based solutions where possible, and reduce drug prices further. We have seen significant reductions in the cost of both first and second-line combinations over the past 3 years. But there's still room for further reduction, as we have just seen last week when President Clinton announced that tenofovir-based triple therapy now is available for just $125 per person a year. Experience has taught us that such reductions must come from a combination of innovation in drug design and production, activism, optimal use of flexibilities within TRIPS, as well as incentives and competition. The management cost of AIDS programs varies significantly from under 5% of total cost in South America to 20% average in sub-Saharan Africa and around 30% in the Caribbean and Middle East. There is substantial scope for savings here. It is also clear that externally driven solutions are the costliest. Overhead goes down by 18% for every dollar of aid that is replaced by domestic funding. Colleagues and friends, taxpayers want to know that the money is used as efficiently as possible. But cost reductions alone cannot ensure that we will reach our ambitious prevention and treatment goals for the coming decade. We need to find additional resources. To do so, we need to think new. And to think new, we need to understand the way the world is changing around us. This is a map of the world for the year 2000. The red countries are those considered low income by the World Bank. This picture has shaped our worldview until today. But see what has happened and what will continue to happen as we go to 2020. In just 8 years from now, the number of poor countries will have declined from 73 to 20. The trend is even stronger if you look at AIDS. Look at the red section of these bars and how it changes. In 2000, when we began the fight for universal access to prevention and treatment and the creation of the Global Fund, 70% of people with HIV lived in low-income countries. 8 years from now, it is about 13%. However, while many countries are getting richer, most people in them are not. Most of the world's poorest people already live in middle-income countries, and this trend will not abate over the coming decade. The chasm between the rich and the poor remains as wide as ever. What is changing is that the challenge of redistribution of resources is increasingly a domestic one, rather than being a matter of transfers from rich countries to poor ones. While many rapidly growing economies have made significant efforts to reduce poverty and increase health spending, there's an acute danger that hundreds of millions of people in countries that are marginally richer will suffer as their countries become less eligible for foreign aid and the domestic policies and dramatic inequality disfavor the poor. Take South Africa as just one example. This graph represents its economic growth. And these bars represent the share of the country's income held by each quintile of the population. See the purple bar at the bottom? That is the share of income held by the 20% who are the poorest. It has not even budged despite a doubling of the GDP over the past decade. We need to go beyond thinking of the nation as the only relevant entity. What is happening within these rapidly growing economies is an even more rapid urbanization and a sharper split between the poor countryside and the increasingly wealthy cities. And with urbanization, we see an increasing share of people with HIV who live in cities. Big cities will become the battleground of the pandemic, but they will also be where there are most resources available to dedicate to the fight against AIDS. In 2025, 60% of the global wealth will be concentrated in just 600 big cities around the globe, home to 25% of the world's population. And 2 out of every 3 people living with HIV will live in urban areas. There's a huge unexplored potential for all of us to approach the new breed of urban entrepreneurs and municipal authorities to discuss how best to fight AIDS street by street and quarter by quarter. But it demands a different approach, since cities face very different problems and opportunities than found in the countryside. Estimated global HIV funding levels leveled off to a flatlining in international funding since 2009. However, global resources were up 11% in 2011 because of a steady increase of domestic resources in low- and middle-income countries, with Brazil, South Africa, China, the Russian Federation, and India leading the way. This means a remarkable turning point. Overall, a 15% growth in domestic resources more than made up for the stagnation in international funding. In fact, 81 countries increased domestic funding by more than 50% between 2006 and 2011. And for the first time ever, domestic resources exceed international funding. About half of this increase came from Africa. But still, only a couple of countries in the African Union are living up to their national leaders' own commitments of dedicating 15% of their domestic budgets to health. It is not unreasonable for people in these countries to demand that their governments live up to that pledge. The lives of more than 80% of the people who receive AIDS treatment in Africa depend every day, every morning, on whether or not a donor writes another check. That is unacceptable. Such dependency simply must end. Health spending in low and middle income countries was about $710 billion in 2011. If we do nothing else than apply growth in GDP to current health budgets, this will add an additional $670 billion by 2020. If countries were to raise health budgets to 15% of global government revenue, domestic health spending would increase from just over $700 billion to over $2 trillion by 2020. Surely, some of such increases should benefit AIDS. And while countries are faced with many challenges, remember, we are just looking for $7 billion more. One of the important challenges in most middle-income countries is to establish reliable sources of predictable government revenue. The conventional wisdom for an efficient tax is to set a low rate at a large base. Taxation of transactions or specific products is also seen as an effective way to steer development and discourage unhealthy practices. Tobacco taxes, fuel taxes, and financial transaction taxes all have been considered and in some countries introduced over the past years. In fact, 15 of the G20 countries already have some form of a financial securities transaction tax, and this is important. When we look at new revenue, we need to realize that while imposing taxes is never easy, it is considerably more feasible to do so country by country than to organize a global agreement, even if a global agreement were desirable. Behind me are examples of taxes, some of which are already implemented in one or several African countries. We've extrapolated this to all of Sub-Saharan Africa to give you an idea of the magnitude. While we cannot expect that all of these would be implemented at the same time, each one of these approaches could generate significant resources in the fight against AIDS domestically. To fight for the poor and marginalized, to ensure that AIDS is seen as a national challenge, even in concentrated epidemic countries, to exploit opportunities for domestic funding, none of this will be achieved without a strong activist voice. I believe that the biggest challenge for the global AIDS activist movement today is to turn the focus back on the human rights and health responsibilities of governments in individual countries. We need to strengthen national activist movements. Let me be clear. Let us not take the pressure off the world's richest countries to meet their commitments and obligations, but let us not believe that the only solution to winning the fight against AIDS lies with heckling the G8 leaders. where we need to see the energy and resources of the activist movement is on support for national movements for health and for those at the far margins of society, particularly those wrongly criminalized, men who have sex with men and transgender people, sex workers, and people who use drugs. This is also where development partners can be very strategic. The recent cut in traditional donor spending has hit NGOs, national NGOs like the South Africa's Treatment Action Campaign, the hardest. Donor funding should be channeled to activists fighting for domestic solution, holding governments responsible for the human rights obligations for all their citizens. And my advice to the global networks, provide outside pressure where useful, but more than anything else, train, support, and encourage concrete rights-based movements and solutions from within, country by country, city by city, and province by province. Friends, I've talked at length about the possibilities of increased domestic funding for HIV in low and middle-income countries. However, let us not forget that there will be quite a number of low and middle-income countries and people that will continue to need significant amounts of outside assistance for the next decade and beyond. That is why we need to continue to push for global solidarity, such as evidenced by the Global Fund and PEPFAR, as the main sources of external funding for AIDS today. They need to get the resources to do what is needed. Let us not forget that despite the global financial crisis, there is still economic growth in OECD countries. And if we did nothing else than apply this economic growth to wealth, to current levels of ODA, there could be another $50 billion annually by 2020, in addition to the $130 billion that we have today. And as I have shown to you before, clearly, with more than 70 high-income countries by 2020, we do need to think beyond the traditional ODA of 22 OECD countries. But let us also explore new sources of income at the global level. Many of you have dedicated much time and effort to securing a global financial transaction tax. This is one great opportunity. But let me also mention some others. The IMF and the World Bank have argued that over time, markets and governments should price carbon tax more explicitly through taxes and other means. A tax on shipping and aviation fuel could raise more than $64 annually, much of which would, of course, go to compensate for the damage of global warming, but which also conceivably could be used for health. Some years ago, much thinking went into front-loading investments for health through bonds, etc. Such opportunities are far from fully explored. Bill Gates has mentioned the potential for investments by the many sovereign wealth funds that now exist, although he did not focus on health for such investments. He also pointed out the option of issuing so-called diaspora funds. Israel and India have already successfully experienced with this, and about $4 billion could be generated with such bonds if people in diaspora would invest no more than 1% of their savings in them. A truly innovative way of financing could be if the billions of dollars which the United States, the European Union, and other countries occasionally charge in fines to pharmaceutical companies for anti-competitive practices could be set aside for health assistance rather than disappear in the general coffers of these countries. A few weeks ago, a single multinational company paid $3 billion in such fines. $3 billion could easily pay for a year of drugs for all those in treatment today. I can already hear the cries of protest among financial bureaucrats, but let us ask our next speaker, Howard Koh, the Deputy Secretary of Health and Human Services, to put in a good word for us. Friends, when it comes to funding the future response to AIDS and getting to zero, I have hope. Let us not accept the notion that we cannot find the relatively humble resources that to pay for the basic services that mean life for those in greatest need. The world overall is getting richer. We have to make it fairer. We will be able to deliver drugs and services more cheaply and more efficiently. We can take the tough decisions and focus on what makes the biggest difference and stop what doesn't. With only a fraction of the new innovative funding sources that I've outlined here, we can make it. The progress so far has been phenomenal. In 2010, domestic funding for AIDS was larger than international funding for the first time ever. It would be exactly the wrong moment for international donors to cut back funding now that the dynamic is going the right way, when we are finally on a path towards sustainability and equity and truly shared responsibility and a true global solidarity. It is exactly 10 years ago in the conference in Barcelona that I put forward the goal of reaching 3 million people with treatment by 2025. We are at 8 million today. The global AIDS movement has achieved amazing results over the past 30 years, and there is no reason why it should not continue to drive change, innovation, health, and human rights for all. Friends, together we will end AIDS. Thank you.
Please welcome Diane Havlier, U.S. co-chair of the AIDS 2012 conference.
Our next speaker, it's my pleasure to introduce, is Dr. Howard Koh. He is the Assistant Secretary of Health of the United States Department of Human and Health Services, a former Commissioner of Public Health of the Commonwealth of the State of Massachusetts. He has also served as a professor of medicine and associate dean at the Harvard School of Public Health, a graduate of Yale College and Medical School. He is the author of over 200 papers and the recipient of numerous awards. It was not until 2010 that the United States had its first national AIDS strategy introduced by President Obama. This strategic plan has shaped the public health response for our country over the last 2 years. So now I welcome Dr. Koh to address Building on Success, a National Strategy to Save Lives.
Dear friends and colleagues, I am so honored to join you this morning on behalf of the United States government to present the status of our commitments for an AIDS-free generation. In particular, I am so pleased to review the development and implementation of the first ever comprehensive U.S. National HIV/AIDS Strategy, which addresses many of the domestic challenges already reviewed at this conference. This strategy also incorporates lessons learned from our many domestic and global partners. It was more than 30 years ago when the first HIV cases were identified in the United States. During this critical time, I was beginning my tenure as the chief medical resident at Boston City Hospital. I will never forget the patients we lost and the way they suffered. Since then, more than 640,000 Americans have lost their lives to AIDS. And today, an estimated 1.1 million people are living with HIV in the United States. One in five is unaware of his or her infection. While the U.S. incidence remained relatively stable in recent years, with approximately 50,000 new infections annually, this figure is unacceptably high. We also know that in the United States, the burden of HIV is not shared equally by population or by region. Populations most affected include men who have sex with men of all races, in particular African American and Latino men, women of color and transgender women, people who use drugs, and young people, especially young black men who have sex with men. The regions most affected include urban areas, the Northeast, and the South. None of this is acceptable. So many in our country have contributed to building a system of early detection that, by providing linkages to ongoing care, leads to viral suppression. But in the United States, only 1 in 4 people living with HIV currently achieves the level of viral suppression needed to preserve health and reduce the risk of HIV transmission to uninfected partners. National strategies are critical to effective country leadership on HIV. National strategies outline a framework for responding to HIV/AIDS in ways that reflect each country's unique epidemiology, disease burden, and trends. And they demonstrate the importance of country ownership and the need to maximize the efficiency and effectiveness of HIV/AIDS programs. In 2009, President Obama made it a top priority of his administration to develop a comprehensive national HIV/AIDS strategy. When drafting the plan, the White House Office of National AIDS Policy consulted with people living with HIV, community-based programs, healthcare providers, researchers, public health experts, and others. The White House Office of National AIDS Policy also consulted with PEPFAR and reviewed existing HIV strategies from various countries in the global North and South. PEPFAR has long prioritized supporting countries as they develop and implement national strategies, maximizing the efficiency and effectiveness of our programs is a shared area of emphasis between PEPFAR and domestic HIV efforts. The following year, 2010, when President Obama unveiled the National HIV/AIDS Strategy, he noted, and I quote, "The actions we take now will build upon a legacy of global leadership, national commitment, and sustained efforts on the part of Americans from all parts of the country and all walks of life to end the HIV epidemic in the United States and around the world." This process of community dialogue continues today. The White House recently completed a series of these community dialogues across the nation where ideas for implementation at the local level were discussed with key stakeholders. And to date, the national strategy has reinvigorated our efforts and re-energized our communities under one unifying set of goals. And in a short period of time, we have demonstrated progress on the national strategy's 3 key goals. In particular, each of the goals is guided by strong science and solid evidence of what works best. We have the benefit of the world's leading scientists and researchers at the National Institutes of Health. They and other researchers across the U.S. and the world have contributed to many of the scientific breakthroughs that provide us with the knowledge and tools to end AIDS. The national strategy's first goal is to reduce new HIV infections because, after all, this is a preventable disease. By the year 2015, we seek to lower the number of new infections by 25%. We plan to do this by reducing the HIV transmission rate and increasing the percentage of people living with HIV who know their serostatus. To reach these targets, as well as support similar global efforts to reduce HIV incidence, NIH continues to invest in cutting-edge prevention research related to vaccines and microbicides. And we are so pleased to see greater emphasis on the use of treatment as prevention. Also, last week's approval of Truvada by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration marks a milestone for pre-exposure prophylaxis and adds another tool to our efforts to reduce incidence. As part of the national strategy, all Department of Health and Human Services agencies are charged with realigning federal dollars to concentrate on both geographic areas and populations with the greatest need. To that end, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention launched high-impact prevention strategies in the most heavily affected populations and is promoting its recommendation that every adolescent and adult get tested for HIV at least once in his or her lifetime, and that those at increased risk get tested at least once per year. For example, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has released a new social marketing campaign called Testing Makes Us Stronger that was designed for and in consultation with African-American gay and bisexual men, the fastest growing demographic in the United States for HIV infection. Meanwhile, the department's Health Resources and Services Administration's national network of 8,100 publicly funded community health centers has scaled up HIV testing for low-income people, leading to a 13% increase in persons tested last year alone. And communities are implementing more creative strategies. Here in the nation's capital, the District of Columbia's Department of Health makes HIV testing available at the Department of Motor Vehicles so customers waiting in line for a driver's license or other services can get a free HIV test. Up to 35 people are taking advantage of this resource every day. We need to continue to build on this effort and others to reach people in non-traditional settings. The second goal of the national strategy is to increase access to care and improve health outcomes for people living with HIV, since fewer than 50% are retained in consistent care. Currently, the Health Resources and Services Administration's Ryan White HIV/AIDS program, a federal government program that provides services to low-income people, and our publicly funded community health centers are working together to expand nationwide access to care for people living with HIV. In addition, the new healthcare law signed by President Obama 2 years ago is crucial for HIV/AIDS and implementing the national HIV/AIDS strategy. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, we are putting into place common sense rules that prevent insurance companies from locking people with HIV/AIDS out of the market by capping their care or by refusing to sell or renew policies because of their pre-existing condition. Specifically, the pre-existing condition ban will apply to all Americans on January 1st, 2014, and is already in effect for children. The Affordable Care Act will also soon expand access to preventive services, including making HIV screening available for women at no cost. And in 2014, it will extend coverage to millions more Americans that will result in a dramatic expansion of coverage to people living with HIV. Recently, the United States Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, announced two important actions relevant to the national strategy's second goal. First, the Secretary announced nearly $80 million in new grant awards that will expand care to an additional 14,000 low-income people living with HIV/AIDS, and, based on estimates provided by state administrators, will eliminate any waiting lists for AIDS drug treatment. Also, Secretary Sebelius announced that the department is working in partnership with the MAC-AIDS Fund to pilot a program that will use mobile phone texting to provide important tips and reminders about disease management to people living with HIV. The third goal of the national strategy is to address HIV-related health disparities in our nation. Complex social and economic factors, including poverty, stigma, and the lack of access to care, limit opportunities for prevention and treatment. To better address many of these social determinants of health, we've expanded our efforts to work across programs administered by our colleagues in other federal agencies, such as the Departments of Housing and Urban Development, Labor, Justice, and Veterans Affairs. We have also engaged leading national organizations to support populations hardest hit by HIV. For example, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Act Against AIDS Leadership Initiative represents a partnership of leading national African American and Latino organizations. It is designed to increase prevention efforts through outreach, communication, and mobilization. In the United States, women and girls account for 23% of all new HIV diagnoses. Among women, the epidemic disproportionately affects women of color, particularly black women. And tragically, gender-based violence often goes hand in hand with the disease. Women and girls are all too frequently victimized by intimate partner violence and sexual assault. This not only increases risk for acquiring HIV, it also blocks women and girls from seeking prevention options and treatment. This is unacceptable. So, in an effort to address gender disparities, the White House recently established an interagency working group on the intersection of HIV/AIDS, violence against women and girls, and gender-related health disparities. This group is working to share best practices, facilitate research, and foster opportunities for partnerships. Finally, we know that stigma drives discrimination and disparities. As a result, too many Americans avoid learning their HIV status, disclosing their status, or accessing medical care. To overcome stigma, our efforts include a new Centers for Disease Control and Prevention campaign called Let's Stop HIV Together, which features people living with HIV standing with their family and friends and calling on all Americans to join the fight against the disease. This national communications effort will not only address stigma associated with the infection, but also complacency about the epidemic. We must prevent the next generation from suffering the burdens we have witnessed in the past. In conclusion, we are making important progress in the first 2 years of the National HIV/AIDS Strategy, but much more lies ahead. We can succeed by making our international public health community even stronger. Over the years, the United States has been part of efforts to build that community along with so many domestic and global partners. And in particular, PEPFAR has coordinated the power of us working together to plan, coordinate, and collaborate to save lives. So as we go forward, let us reflect on the past, but accelerate our efforts in the fight against HIV/AIDS for the future. Here in the United States, we believe the National HIV/AIDS Strategy can bring us closer to a vision of a society where new infections are rare and everyone receives the care they need and deserve. You can follow our efforts to implement the strategy on AIDS.gov. My hope is that together we can seize this moment of opportunity and channel its momentum toward achieving our goal of an AIDS-free generation. Thank you very much. Okay. Hey, Senator.
On behalf of my co-chairs this morning, I would like, and on behalf of you, I would like to thank all the speakers this morning who give us perspective to end with HIV. So now you have a break, and there will be another session on the clinical studies in this room.